gone on trial at Newcastle Crown Court, accused of cutting down the famous Sycamore Gap tree in September 2023. BBC News.
With Vijay Alice. Not to be missed, David Sedaris takes the chair in just a moment, offering us some insight on small talk in his own unique and entertaining way after this.
Hello, I'm Michael Spicer. Steve Coogan won critical acclaim recently for playing four different roles in the West End production of Doctor Strangelove. In the new series of Michael Spicer, No Room, I play 96 roles. And here they all are. Now, does this mean statistically I'm 24 times better than Steve Coogan? Well, that's really not for me to say, but possibly yes. Anyway, you can judge for yourself by listening to Michael Spicer, No Room, which returns to Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow night at 11.
Now on Radio 4, what are you like at small talk? American satirist David Sedaris has been giving it some thought in tonight's 6:30 comedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet David Sedaris.
You're so kind, thank you. This is an essay I wrote called Small Talk. The New York apartment building Hugh and I live in isn't terribly big. I wanted a nice view, so we're on a high floor. The drawback being that we need to rely on the elevator, not for going down so much, but only my friend Dawn would carry a load of groceries up 20 flights of stairs. The building has doormen, so between me and the street, there is definitely one, but more often two or three occasions for small talk. Nobody likes this kind of thing. That said, there's a definite art to it. Not long after we moved in, I was heading to the lobby, and a neighbor I would later get to know as Tommy boarded the elevator one floor below mine. He nodded at me, and as the doors closed, I raised a finger. May I ask you a question? Not if it's about how much to tip the doorman at Christmas, he said. That was exactly what I wanted to know. Quick, I thought, think of a replacement. Can you recommend a cobbler, I asked. Now it is 5 years later. I'm on my way to the lobby, and when a woman boards at 14, I ask, how long have you known your dentist? She thinks for a moment, 15 years, why? Just curious, I say. I knew my old one for almost that long, but then we moved to New York and I had to start over. And where did you move here from, she asks. And then we're off, pleasantly conversing until we part ways on the ground floor. How long have you known your dentist is such a good ice-breaking question. A real keeper, in my opinion. I didn't make it up. It's not mine. Rather, I found it on Duolingo. An app my friend Dave turned me onto. He's been using it to learn Spanish. Me, I started with Japanese. It offers over 40 languages, everything short of Elvish, I think. Each program features the same cast of animated characters, the excitable little boy, the bored teenage girl with hair covering her face. There's an athletic-looking blonde fellow, Vikram, who wears a turban, 11 in all, including a talking bear named Falstaff. Sometimes Duolingo will give me a sentence in English, how many desks are in the room, and I have to translate it into Japanese, choosing from the menu of words written in hiragana at the bottom of the screen. Other times I have to read a sentence out loud, and the characters will either accept or reject me, based upon my pronunciation. My least favorite is when they give me a sentence, and I have to write it in whichever language I'm studying. If you've only ever learned English, you maybe don't know that in other countries, I gave her the suitcase might go, I gave to her the suitcase, or I had to her of the suitcase gave. You have to grasp a new word order. Often the nouns have hard to remember genders. then there's a spelling to worry about. My friend Mike is learning Yiddish with Duolingo. And one of the sentences it taught him is, "My uncle is a broken man." I used its French program to freshen up before a trip to Paris not long ago, and was both surprised and not by the question, "What is he doing in our bed?" I'm a dilettante and always have been. Rather than really buckling down and mastering anything, I flit from one language to the next. Thus, I noted how different Duolingo's Japanese was from Duolingo's German version. In the latter, the characters have definite opinions. "Your apartment is dark and ugly." "I don't like your sweater." They give the impression that German people are direct and judgmental, but also outdoorsy, generous, and sure of themselves. Thus, such sentences as, "I'm sorry, but your doctor is playing volleyball today." "I am giving 100 toilets to my father." And "Spain needs us." There's a lot of talk about witches, but no mention of them dating one another. This as opposed to Duolingo's Japanese program where seemingly everyone is gay. "Is that your grandmother's new girlfriend?" is one of the questions I was taught. Suddenly, the guy with the headband on had a husband as well as a son. Even the bear was dating another guy. I often complained about the last Japanese learning program I used, Pimsleur. So much of the talk was, as it is on their German and Polish and Romanian courses, about drinking. "You want a beer? Wine? Sake? Whiskey? How many bottles? Should we drink at your place or mine? What time should we start drinking? Do you know what Tanaka-san drinks? Does his wife drink too? Have you ever had drinks with his parents?" Pimsleur taught me a lot of practical things, though, like how to make reservations and buy train tickets. What track do I leave on? What time do we arrive? Is it an express train or a super express train? When it comes to icebreaker questions, though, the type one might ask in an elevator, both Pimsleur and Duolingo pale compared to Teach Yourself Japanese, a book a woman in England sent me a few pages of. It was what her dad used back in the 50s. And it includes the phrases, "What will become of us if father dies?" "Grandmother has turned blind." "The man with the small hands is my friend." "I no longer take any pleasure in my work." "Shall I kill myself tomorrow?" "And it is only the third bottle from the left which has poison in it." What age, I wonder, are these students? If you no longer take pleasure in your work, I'm guessing you've been at it for a while, yet your grandmother is still alive and newly blind. And just how small are your friend's hands? I'm thinking of someone with the equivalent of raccoon paws trying to open a bottle of pills he can kill himself with. Depressing phrases or practical ones, you'll never become fluent through an app or a book, no matter how many hours you devote to it. You have to talk to actual people. My friend Scott has tutors in both Japanese and French and is miles ahead of me in terms of conversing and understanding. He does his lessons once a week on Zoom. I suppose I could do the same, but I'm afraid I won't like the tutor and won't know how to put an end to our relationship. It's the same reason I don't see a psychiatrist or hire a trainer. Most of the doormen in my apartment building are from Ecuador, and one, Adrian, has, at my request, begun speaking to me exclusively in Spanish. I took it in high school, so we didn't have to start from scratch. The problem is that, because he essentially works for me, He's not going to be as strict as, say, the French teacher I had in Paris. Not that I'm not progressing. Recently, I learned that Adrian calls his mother gordita, which means little fatty. It's a nice bit of information to start your day with, though it leaves me wondering and phrasing the question to myself in Japanese, French, German, and now tentatively in Spanish. What does he call me? A lot of people use Duolingo. I can tell because when I say Duolingo, people clap and laugh. It taps perfectly into my mental illness. And so I have to be in the top three in the Diamond League. If I weren't doing this, I'd be second. Second place is just the person's 1,500 points ahead of me. I could have easily licked that person, but not to be. This is called Good Grief. Scrolling through my address book on a recent morning, I noticed how many of the people in it are no longer alive. It would be easy enough to remove their contact information. This is a digital version on my laptop, but I can't bring myself to do it. I suppose it's partly a mortality exercise. When the dead outnumber the living, I should probably get my affairs in order. But more than that, it's a way of remembering these various friends and acquaintances. And at odd moments, when I'm traveling, for instance, I'm in at breakfast alone in a hotel dining room, wondering who I might send a postcard to. Oh, right, I think. Melissa Bank, a writer who died in 2022. She and I wrote one another, but got together only once, in San Francisco, when both of us were there on book tours. Over dinner, we fell onto the subject of teaching and of how bad we both were at it. I was at Cornell for a while, she told me. They assigned me a class called Writing About Film, which I liked the idea of, but was totally unprepared for. On the first day, she had her students watch Godard's Breathless. It was one of her all-time favorites, but that didn't mean she had any great insights to offer. In this movie, Jean Seberg has really short hair, she said to her students afterwards. Do you think my hair would look good short? Before going to dinner with Melissa, I'd had lunch with my old college roommate, Todd Bennett, another person whose address I can't seem to erase. I met him my first day at Kent State. Walked into our dorm room, there he was, his carrot-colored hair cut into a shag. Dress him in different clothing, and he might have come from another century. Some people just have that look about them. Todd's eyes were red-rimmed and heavy-lidded. His face was long, and his mouth, which was full of big, crooked teeth, never quite closed all the way. He resembled one of those Dutch noblemen huddled in the background of a painting that's always about the more noble nobleman standing in the foreground. I was an out-of-state student, but Todd was local, from Dayton. When he was young, before his parents divorced, he'd often catch his mother sneaking boyfriends into their house. She threatened that if I said anything to my dad, she'd take away my asthma inhaler. He told me once as we were lying on our bunks, passing a joint from top to bottom. At the time we were roommates, Todd's mom was a barmaid and went to work wearing hot pants. His life was so different from my own, so much more exciting. There are friends you know for a year or two, and others you're with for a lifetime. In the days before cell phones and email, it took real work to stay in touch, especially if you moved around a lot. Still, Todd and I managed. I wound up dropping out of Kent State, but he graduated, I believe, with a degree in social work. Then he moved to San Francisco, became a law librarian, and contracted AIDS, dying of it in 2021. Following him in my address book, there's my first agent, Don Congdon. How old is he? My writer friends used to ask. I'd answer that he used to represent Walt Whitman. Don seemed ancient when I signed with him in the early 1990s, though in retrospect, he was only in his late 70s then. He looked like the man on the Monopoly board, white hair with a matching puffy mustache, but even more dapper, always with some final perfect touch, a beret, or a bright psychedelic poochie necktie he'd bought in the 60s. At our first meeting, he mentioned the night that he and Jerry Salinger went to see Billie Holiday at a club in Greenwich Village, of the time he represented Lillian Hellman for a production of The Little Foxes. Most of what he told me during our first meeting, he repeated at the second, then the third, and so on. I'd fantasized about an agent who would talk all about me and my work, but I rarely came up in our one-sided conversations. Instead, it was Jackie Kennedy, Salinger, Thomas Berger, William Manchester. Not that I was unhappy. Look at me, I'd think, at lunch with William Styron's agent. As he got older, Don forgot words such as book and publish. But did his best to work around them. His advancing dementia didn't alarm me until my publisher offered a generous amount for a new book and was told, "Oh, David doesn't need that much money." He died in his sleep, Don, the way we'd all like to. My sister Tiffany is still in my address book, as is my father, and Hughes as well. Sam was brutally, almost ridiculously handsome with a deep voice and a real talent for intimidating people. Once, while he was visiting Hugh and me in Normandy, I came upon him stretched out on our bed, reading a copy of my first book. "You know," he offered, looking up as I entered the room, "this isn't good at all." By Judith Mallon. A woman I used to clean for who gave me the opium pipe that had belonged to the poet Harry Crosby. By Ian Falconer, the artist and author I did a children's book with. At a meeting once to discuss a story collection he was illustrating for me, I jotted something in my notebook and he looked down at the page saying, "Oh my God, you have handwriting just like Hitler's." Who on earth knows what Hitler's handwriting looked like? I remember thinking. By Elaine Stritch and Harold Ramis, neither of whom I knew well, but who were in my address book, nevertheless. By Phyllis Diller, who was a friend and told me shocking things about Nancy Reagan. There's Harry Rowoldt, who translated the first two books of mine to come out in Germany. He wrote as well and played a vagrant on a popular soap opera called Lindenstrasse. Harry looked like Santa after a rough couple of years. Shoulder-length gray hair with a long matching beard, little round wire-rimmed glasses. Cell phones were a new thing when we met in 1999. And whenever he saw someone talking on one, he'd move in close and shout, "Come back to bed, I'm freezing." Harry and I read together quite often in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. "How long will the evening last?" I asked on our first night in Hamburg. "A bottle," he said. He didn't mean a small one either. Our presentation started at 8 and didn't end until he'd polished off an entire fifth of whiskey. "What did you do this morning?" I asked him the following day as we staggered to the train station. "Took a shit. Put a suppository up my ass for hemorrhoids and made some phone calls in the nude," he told me. That was when I learned that, "Oh, nothing much," isn't really in the German vocabulary. Neither is me. "Oh, I'm fine." Harry died of lung cancer at 70. A number of other friends have died of cancer. Marge Lurie, Chris Neal, Doug Trezair, the writer David Rakoff, who I loved like a brother. The last time we saw each other, he was hollowed out, a husk. I was leaving the next day for France, wouldn't be back in New York for another 4 months, and knew he wouldn't last until then. Yet, I didn't hug or kiss him, didn't see him home and hover over him until he begged me to leave. I wanted to do all these things, but instead, I shook his hand. Instead, I said, "See ya," the way one might say, "Night," as doing otherwise might suggest that he was going to die. And what if he didn't want that acknowledged? What if he was holding out hope, and one single person not holding it out with him might topple the whole enterprise? The truth is that I'm afraid of sick people. It's almost how I feel around famous people. False, unworthy, laughing at their jokes before they even reach the punchlines. Even with my own mother, I felt that way. 32 years after her death, when my sister Gretchen was diagnosed with the exact same cancer, I acted as if it was nothing more than the flu. "It's in the lung," I said when she told me about it. "Oh, that's no big deal. I'm not sure it even qualifies as a serious illness anymore. That's how advanced the treatments are." After her first PET scan, she called to say that the cancer was actually in both lungs and had spread to her lymph nodes. I was in New York at the time, walking through Central Park. "Well, did they say which lymph nodes?" I asked, wondering if it matters. "A doctor told me I had cancer back in 2019, I reminded her. "Then it turned out to be nothing but a UTI. I mean, people make mistakes all the time." I was trying to sound positive, but trying even harder not to cry and scare her off the phone. "My remarkable sister," I thought. Cancer. The last time I'd seen her, she was chugging water from a vodka bottle that still had the label on it. We were at the airport and people were staring at her. It was, I thought, the funniest thing in the world. I was just remembering that soft cashmere cape I saw when I came to London a few years ago, she said. It was at that store, Egg, and would be so nice to wear during my treatments. I was like, "A chemo cape?" "Yeah," she said. The cashmere Egg cape would, I know, be long gone, but I'd seen a great one recently that was made by Rick Owens and was at Bergdorf's. So I turned around and headed down Fifth Avenue to 57th Street because this is what I do. Buy things and hope that the receipt I accidentally, on purpose, leave in the box will say what I, for some reason, cannot. "I love you." I'm frightened. If I could trade my legs for your health, I would. Of course, I'd remind you of it every moment of every day, that my legs were my one and only good feature. But at least on my end, it would be worth it. Normally, the older sibling is supposed to expose the younger one to things. But with Gretchen, it had always been the opposite. She was the first in our family to have an exterior life, adventures with friends who did drugs and drove out to rock quarries in the middle of the night. She was the first to have sex and the first to play records the rest of us had never heard of. I've never seen a brother or sister in a movie or TV show who were as close as Gretchen and I when we were in our teens. Once, as we sat on the grass beside a lake, I realized with the clarity one can only achieve by taking acid in the middle of a weekday that she was the most beautiful girl I had ever seen. "Just keep your glasses off," I told her. I'd gone back to that afternoon a dozen times since learning she had cancer, recalling us at the water's edge the moment before our adult lives started. And we slowly drifted away from one another, still closer than most grown siblings, but nothing like we'd been in high school. One being with two heads. "Please still be there," I said to myself, as I crossed 60th Street, then 59th and 57th. It was as if this cape, and only this cape, could save my sister's life. When I reached the top floor of Bergdorf's and saw that the cape was still right where I'd left it, I thought, I'll admit it, please be on sale. That, though, was too much to ask. The important thing was that they had it. The cape cost $2,400. It was black and made of heavy wool, was a blanket, essentially, with a closure at the neck. My sister has pretty bad cancer, I told the salesman who waited on me, so I'd like to buy this for her and have it shipped. I'd wanted to get the cape from myself when I first saw it a few weeks earlier, and would have had I not just spent a bundle of money on a long coat made of two black sport coats sewn together, top to bottom. I mean, it had four sleeves. How could I resist? It's beautiful, the salesman, whose last name was Yamada, observed. He laid the cape flat on the counter and gently ran his hand over it, as if it were a living thing he needed to calm down. I'm thinking that, should worse come to worse, I'll get it back one day, I said. Grateful that Gretchen, who started smoking at age 14 and kept it up for 51 years, had quit 3 months earlier. You can't smoke and wear a cape. You'll burn holes in it. That's a guarantee. I gave Mr. Yamada my credit card and the shipping details. Then I left the store and called my sister Amy to see if she wanted to go in on it with me, saying I'd buy out her half when Gretchen dies. Not now of cancer, I said, but say 20 years down the line. And if something else, old age, say, or a drive-by shooting. Of course I'll go in on it, Amy said. Are you kidding? That's the perfect cancer gift. The cape had just arrived at Gretchen's house in North Carolina when she got the news that actually the cancer hadn't spread to her lymph nodes and was only in one lung, not two. A tiny speck. It's like the tumor sprouted at 8 a.m. and she went to the doctor at noon. In the end, they cut it out and she was fine after that. No radiation, no chemo. I was, of course, greatly relieved. But at the same time, I thought, I want that cape back. I looked for one at the Rick Owens store in New York, but they were out. Everyone was. Can you believe this shit? I said to Amy. She's someone I really couldn't bear to outlive. The thought of it is obscene to me. The same is true of Gretchen, of course, and my other siblings, and Hugh, and my old friends, Dawn and Ronnie. But it happens, and somehow you do bear it, just as I bear the death of my mother and of the lovely David Rakoff. People die. You wonder how you'll get through the day without them, and through some miracle, you manage. It's just, I suspect, much easier in a Rick Owens cape.
Meet David Sedaris was written and read by David Sedaris. It was produced by Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for BBC Radio 4.
And next week, David gets some sad news that leads him to recalling great times with his childhood best friend. And that's followed by a short story about mispronunciation. Now, after the news, Rochelle is out of options and Rex attempts some aftercare when we're in Ambridge for the Archers. That's in a couple of minutes. First, though, how's this for a holiday checklist?
On BBC iPlayer.
OK, let's go.
The Race Across the World Guide to Travel.
We're off!
Plan ahead.
Do you have the map and stuff?
No.
Are you serious?
Spend wisely.
How much?
Last money gone.
Remember to relax.
We need to go now.
Quick.
I'm tired and I'm knackered.
Absolute mayhem.
Goodbye, comfort zone.
It's the toughest thing I've ever done.
Race Across the World is back.
This is amazing.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.